"'What do you mean?' Razumihin shouted suddenly, as though he had reflected and realized. "'Why, it was on the day of the murder the painters were at work. And he was there 3 days before. What are you asking?' "'Phew, I have muddled it.' Porfiry slapped himself on the forehead. "'Deuce, take it! This business is turning my brain!' He addressed Raskolnikov somewhat apologetically. "'It would be such a great thing for us to find out whether anyone had seen them between 7 and 8 at the flat, so I fancied you could perhaps have told us something. I quite muddled it.' "'Then you should be more careful.' Razumihin observed grimly. The last words were uttered in the passage. Porfiry Petrovitch saw them to the door with excessive politeness. They went out into the street, gloomy and sullen, and for some steps they did not say a word. Raskolnikov drew a deep breath. Chapter 6 "'I don't believe it. I can't believe it,' repeated Razumihin, trying in perplexity to refute Raskolnikov's arguments. They were by now approaching Bakaleyev's lodgings, where Pulcheria Alexandrovna and Dunya had been expecting them a long while. Razumihin kept stopping on the way in the heat of discussion, confused and excited by the very fact that they were for the first time speaking openly about it. "'Don't believe it, then,' answered Raskolnikov with a cold, careless smile. "'You were noticing nothing as usual, but I was weighing every word. "'You're suspicious. That's why you weighed their words. Certainly, I agree, Porfiry's tone was rather strange, and still more that wretch Zamyatov. You are right, there was something about him, but why? Why? He has changed his mind since last night. Quite the contrary. If they had that brainless idea, they would do their utmost to hide it and conceal their cards so as to catch you afterwards. But it was all impudent and careless. If they had had facts, I mean real facts, or at least grounds for suspicion, then they would certainly have tried to hide their game in the hope of getting more. They would have made a search long ago, besides, but they have no facts, not one. It's all mirage, all ambiguous, simply a floating idea, so they try to throw me out by impudence. And perhaps he was irritated at having no facts, and blurted it out in his vexation, or perhaps he has some plan. He seems an intelligent man. Perhaps he wanted to frighten me, by pretending to know. They have a psychology of their own, brother. But it is loathsome explaining it all. Stop! And it's insulting! Insulting! I understand you, but since we have spoken openly now, and it's an excellent thing that we have at last, I'm glad. I will own now, frankly, that I noticed it in them long ago, this idea. Of course, the merest hint only, an insinuation, but why an insinuation even? How dare they? What foundation have they? If only you knew how furious I have been. Think only, simply because a poor student, unhinged by poverty and hypochondria, on the eve of a severe delirious illness, note that. Suspicious, vain, proud, who has not seen a soul to speak to for 6 months in rags and in boots without soles, has to face some wretched policemen and put up with their insolence. And the unexpected debt thrust under his nose, the IOU presented by Tchebarov, the new paint, 30 degrees Réaumur, and a stifling atmosphere, a crowd of people, the talk about the murder of a person where he had been just before, and all that on an empty stomach. He might well have a fainting fit. And that is what they found it all on. Damn them. I understand how annoying it is, but in your place, Roger, I would laugh at them, or better still, spit in their ugly faces, and spit a dozen times in all directions. I'd hit out in all directions, neatly, too, and so I'd put an end to it. Damn them. Don't be downhearted. It's a shame. He really has put it well, though, Raskolnikov thought. Damn them. But the cross-examination again, tomorrow, he said with bitterness. Must I really enter into explanations with him? I feel vexed as it is that I condescended to speak to Zamyatov yesterday in the restaurant. Damn it, I will go myself to Porfiry. I will squeeze it out of him as one of the family. He must let me know the ins and outs of it all, and as for Zamyatov... At last he sees through him, thought Raskolnikov. Wait, cried Razumihin, seizing him by the shoulder again. Wait, you are wrong. I have thought it out. You are wrong. How was that a trap? You say that the question about the workmen was a trap, but if you had done that, could you have said you had seen them painting the flat and the workmen? On the contrary, you would have seen nothing, even if you had seen it. Who would admit it against himself? If I had done that thing, I should certainly have said that I had seen the workmen and the flat, Raskolnikov answered, with reluctance and obvious disgust. But why speak against yourself? Because only peasants, or the most inexperienced novices, deny everything flatly at examinations. If a man is ever so little developed and experienced, he will certainly try to admit all the external facts that can't be avoided, but will seek other explanations of them, will introduce some special unexpected turn that will give them another significance and put them in another light. Porfiry might well reckon that I should be sure to answer so, and say I had seen them to give an air of truth and then make some explanation. But he would have told you at once that the workmen could not have been there 2 days before, and that therefore you must have been there on the day of the murder at 8 o'clock. And so he would have caught you over a detail.
Yes.
That's what he was reckoning on, that I should not have time to reflect and should be in a hurry to make the most likely answer, and so would forget that the workmen could not have been there 2 days before.
But how could you forget it?
Nothing easier. It's in just such stupid things clever people are most easily caught. The more cunning a man is, the less he suspects that he will be caught in a simple thing. The more cunning a man is, the simpler the trap he must be caught in. Porfiry is not such a fool as you think.
He's a knave, then, if that's so.
Raskolnikov could not help laughing. But at the very moment, he was struck by the strangeness of his own frankness, and the eagerness with which he had made this explanation, though he had kept up all the preceding conversation with gloomy repulsion, obviously with a motive, from necessity.
I am getting a relish for certain aspects, he thought to himself.
But almost at the same instant, he became suddenly uneasy, as though an unexpected and alarming idea had occurred to him. His uneasiness kept on increasing. They had just reached the entrance to Bakaleyev's.
"Go in alone," said Raskolnikov suddenly. "I'll be back directly."
"Where are you going?"
"Why, we're just here."
"I can't help it. I'll come in half an hour. Tell them."
"Say what you like. I'll come with you." "You too want to torture me," he screamed, with such bitter irritation, such despair in his eyes, that Razumihin's hands dropped.
He stood for some time on the steps, looking gloomily at Raskolnikov, striding rapidly away in the direction of his lodging. At last, gritting his teeth and clenching his fist, he swore he would squeeze Porfiry like a lemon that very day, and went up the stairs to reassure Pulcheria Alexandrovna, who was by now alarmed at their long absence. When Raskolnikov got home, his hair was soaked with sweat, and he was breathing heavily. He went rapidly up the stairs, walked into his unlocked room, and at once fastened the latch. Then, in senseless terror, he rushed to the corner, to that hole under the paper where he had put the thing, put his hand in, and for some minutes felt carefully in the hole, in every crack and fold of the paper. Finding nothing, he got up and drew a deep breath. As he was reaching the steps of Bakaleyev's, he suddenly thought that something, a chain, a stud, or even a bit of paper in which they had been wrapped with the old woman's handwriting on it, might somehow have slipped out and been lost in some crack, and then might suddenly turn up as unexpected conclusive evidence against him. He stood as though lost in thought, and a strange, humiliated, half-senseless smile strayed on his lips. He took his cap at last and went quietly out of the room. His ideas were all tangled. He went dreamily through the gateway.
"Here he is himself!"
shouted a loud voice. He raised his head. The porter was standing at the door of his little room, and was pointing him out, to a short man who looked like an artisan, wearing a long coat and a waistcoat, and looking at a distance remarkably like a woman. He stooped, and his head in a greasy cap hung forward. From his wrinkled, flabby face he looked over 50. His little eyes were lost in fat, and they looked out grimly, sternly, and discontentedly. "What is it?" Raskolnikov asked, going up to the porter. The man stole a look at him from under his brows, and he looked at him attentively, deliberately. Then he turned slowly and went out of the gate into the street without saying a word.
"What is it?" cried Raskolnikov.
"Why, he there was asking whether a student lived here, mentioned your name, and whom you lodged with. I saw you coming and pointed you out, and he went away. It's funny."
The porter, too, seemed rather puzzled, but not much so, and after wondering for a moment he turned and went back to his room. Raskolnikov ran after the stranger, and at once caught sight of him walking along the other side of the street with the same even, deliberate step, with his eyes fixed on the ground, as though in meditation. He soon overtook him, but for some time walked behind him. At last, moving on to a level with him, he looked at his face. The man noticed him at once, looked at him quickly, but dropped his eyes again. And so they walked for a minute side by side without uttering a word. "You were inquiring for me of the porter?" Raskolnikov said at last, but in a curiously quiet voice. The man made no answer. He didn't even look at him. Again, they were both silent. "Why do you come and ask for me and say nothing? What's the meaning of it?" Raskolnikov's voice broke, and he seemed unable to articulate the words clearly. The man raised his eyes this time, and turned a gloomy, sinister look at Raskolnikov. "Murderer," he said suddenly, in a quiet but clear and distinct voice. Raskolnikov went on walking beside him. His legs felt suddenly weak. A cold shiver ran down his spine, and his heart seemed to stand still for a moment, then suddenly began throbbing as though it were set free. So they walked for about 100 paces, side by side in silence. The man did not look at him. "What do you mean? What is... who is a murderer?" muttered Raskolnikov, hardly audibly.
"You are a murderer,"
the man answered still more articulately and emphatically, with a smile of triumphant hatred. And again he looked straight into Raskolnikov's pale face and stricken eyes. They had just reached the crossroads. The man turned to the left without looking behind him. Raskolnikov remained standing, gazing after him. He saw him turn round 50 paces away and look back at him, still standing there. Raskolnikov could not see clearly, but he fancied that he was again smiling the same smile of cold hatred and triumph. With slow, faltering steps, with shaking knees, Raskolnikov made his way back to his little garret, feeling chilled all over. He took off his cap and put it on the table, and for 10 minutes he stood without moving. Then he sank, exhausted, on the sofa, and with a weak moan of pain, he stretched himself on it. So he lay for half an hour. He thought of nothing. Some thoughts or fragments of thoughts, some images without order or coherence, floated before his mind. Faces of people he had seen in his childhood, or met somewhere once, whom he would never have recalled, the belfry of the church at V, the billiard table in a restaurant and some officers playing billiards, the smell of cigars in some underground tobacco shop, a tavern room, a back staircase quite dark, all sloppy with dirty water and strewn with eggshells, and the Sunday bells floating in from somewhere. The images followed one another, whirling like a hurricane. Some of them he liked and tried to clutch at, but they faded, and all the while there was an oppression within him. But it was not overwhelming. Sometimes it was even pleasant. The slight shivering still persisted, but that too was an almost pleasant sensation. He heard the hurried footsteps of Razumihin. He closed his eyes and pretended to be asleep. Razumihin opened the door and stood for some time in the doorway as though hesitating. Then he stepped softly into the room and went cautiously to the sofa. Raskolnikov heard Nastasya's whisper, "Don't disturb him. Let him sleep. He can have his dinner later." "Quite so," answered Razumihin. Both withdrew carefully and closed the door. Another half hour passed. Raskolnikov opened his eyes, turned on his back again, clasping his hands behind his head. "Who is he? Who is that man who sprang out of the earth? Where was he? What did he see? He's seen it all, that's clear. Where was he, then? And from where did he see? Why has he only now sprung out of the earth? And how could he see? Is it possible?" Continued Raskolnikov, turning cold and shivering. "And the jewel case Nikolai found behind the door, was that possible? A clue? You miss an infinitesimal line, and you can build it into a pyramid of evidence. A fly flew by and saw it. Is it possible?" He felt with sudden loathing how weak, how physically weak he had become. "I ought to have known it," he thought with a bitter smile. "And how dared I, knowing myself, knowing how I should be, take up an axe and shed blood? I ought to have known beforehand. Ah, but I did know," he whispered in despair. At times he came to a standstill at some thought. "No, those men are not made so. The real master, to whom all is permitted, storms Toulon, makes a massacre in Paris, forgets an army in Egypt, wastes 500,000 men in the Moscow expedition, and gets off with a jest at Vilna. And altars are set up to him after his death. And so all is permitted. No, such people, it seems, are not of flesh, but of bronze." One sudden irrelevant idea almost made him laugh. Napoleon, the pyramids, Waterloo, and a wretched, skinny old woman, a pawnbroker with a red trunk under her bed. It's a nice hash for Porfiry Petrovitch to digest. How can they digest it? It's too inartistic. Would a Napoleon creep under an old woman's bed? Ugh, how loathsome. At moments he felt he was raving. He sank into a state of feverish excitement. The old woman is of no consequence, he thought, hotly and incoherently. The old woman was a mistake, perhaps, but she's not what matters. The old woman was only an illness. I was in a hurry to overstep. I didn't kill a human being, but a principle. I killed the principle, but I didn't overstep. I stopped on this side. I was only capable of killing. And it seems I wasn't even capable of that. Principle. Why was that fool Razumihin abusing the socialists? They are industrious commercial people. The happiness of all is their case. No. Life is only given to me once, and I shall never have it again. I don't want to wait for the happiness of all. I want to live myself, or else better not live at all. I simply couldn't pass by my mother starving, keeping my ruble in my pocket while I waited for the happiness of all. I am putting my little brick into the happiness of all, and so my heart is at peace. Why have you let me slip? I only live once. I, too, want. Ugh, I am an aesthetic louse and nothing more, he added suddenly, laughing like a madman. Yes, I am certainly a louse, he went on, clutching at the idea, gloating over it and playing with it with vindictive pleasure. In the first place, because I can reason that I am one, and secondly, because for a month past I have been troubling benevolent Providence, calling it to witness that not for my own fleshly lusts did I undertake it, but with a grand and noble object. Thirdly, because I aimed at carrying it out as justly as possible, weighing, measuring, and calculating. Of all the lice, I picked out the most useless one and proposed to take from her only as much as I needed for the first step, no more nor less. So the rest would have gone to a monastery according to her will. And what shows that I am utterly a louse, he added, grinding his teeth, is that I am perhaps viler and more loathsome than the louse I killed. And I felt beforehand that I should tell myself so after killing her. Can anything be compared with the horror of that? The vulgarity, the abjectness. I understand the prophet with his saber on his steed, Allah commands, and trembling creation must obey. The prophet is right. He is right when he sets a battery across the street and blows up the innocent and the guilty without deigning to explain. It's for you to obey, trembling creation, and not to have desires, for that's not for you. I shall never, never forgive the old woman. His hair was soaked with sweat, his quivering lips were parched, his eyes were fixed on the ceiling. Mother, sister, how I love them. Why do I hate them now? Yes, I hate them. I feel a physical hatred for them. I can't bear them near me. I went up to my mother and kissed her, I remember, to embrace her and think if she only knew. Shall I tell her then? That's just what I might do. She must be the same as I am, he added, straining himself to think, as it were struggling with delirium. Oh, how I hate the old woman now. I feel I should kill her again if she came to life. Poor Lizaveta. Why did she come in? It's strange, though. Why is it
I scarcely ever think of her as though I hadn't killed her. Lizaveta. Sonia. Poor gentle things with gentle eyes. Dear women. Why don't they weep? Why don't they moan? They give up everything. Their eyes are soft and gentle. Sonia. Sonia. Gentle Sonia. He lost consciousness. It seemed strange to him that he didn't remember how he got into the street. It was late evening. The twilight had fallen, and the full moon was shining more and more brightly. But there was a peculiar breathlessness in the air. There were crowds of people in the street. Workmen and business people were making their way home. Other people had come out for a walk. There was a smell of mortar, dust, and stagnant water. Raskolnikov walked along, mournful and anxious. He was distinctly aware of having come out with a purpose, of having to do something in a hurry. But what it was he had forgotten. Suddenly he stood still and saw a man standing on the other side of the street, beckoning to him. He crossed over to him, but at once the man turned and walked away with his head hanging as though he had made no sign to him. Wait, did he really beckon? Raskolnikov wondered, but he tried to overtake him. When he was within 10 paces, he recognized him and was frightened. It was the same man with stooping shoulders in the long coat. Raskolnikov followed him at a distance. His heart was beating. They went down a turning. The man still didn't look round. "Does he know I am following him?" thought Raskolnikov. The man went into the gateway of a big house. Raskolnikov hastened to the gate and looked in to see whether he would look round and sign to him. In the courtyard the man did turn round and again seemed to beckon him. Raskolnikov at once followed him into the yard, but the man was gone. He must have gone up the first staircase. Raskolnikov rushed after him. He heard slow, measured steps 2 flights above. The staircase seemed strangely familiar. He reached the window on the first floor. The moon shone through the panes with a melancholy and mysterious light. Then he reached the second floor. Bah, this is the flat where the painters were at work. But how was it he didn't recognize it at once? The steps of the man above had died away. So he must have stopped, or hidden somewhere. He reached the third story. Should he go on? There was a stillness. That was dreadful. But he went on. The sound of his own footsteps scared and frightened him. How dark it was! The man must be hiding in some corner here. Ah! The flat was standing wide open. He hesitated and went in. It was very dark and empty in the passage, as though everything had been removed. He crept on tiptoe into the parlor, which was flooded with moonlight. Everything there was as before. The chairs, the looking-glass, the yellow sofa, and the pictures in the frames. A huge, round, copper-red moon looked in at the window. It's the moon that makes it so still, weaving some mystery, thought Raskolnikov. He stood and waited, waited a long while, and the more silent the moonlight, the more violently his heart beat, till it was painful. And still the same hush. Suddenly, he heard a momentary sharp crack, like the snapping of a splinter, and all was still again. A fly flew up suddenly and struck the windowpane with a plaintive buzz. At that moment,
He noticed in the corner, between the window and the little cupboard, something like a cloak hanging on the wall. "Why is that cloak here?" he thought. "It wasn't there before." He went up to it quietly, and felt that there was someone hiding behind it. He cautiously moved the cloak and saw, sitting on a chair in the corner, the old woman, bent double so that he couldn't see her face, but it was she. He stood over her. "She is afraid," he thought. He stealthily took the axe from the noose and struck her one blow, then another on the skull. But strange to say, she didn't stir, as though she were made of wood. He was frightened, bent down nearer and tried to look at her, but she too bent her head lower. He bent right down to the ground and peeped up into her face from below. He peeped and turned cold with horror. The old woman was sitting and laughing, shaking with noiseless laughter, doing her utmost that he shouldn't hear it. Suddenly he fancied that the door from the bedroom was opened a little, and that there was laughter and whispering within. He was overcome with frenzy, and he began hitting the old woman on the head with all his force. But at every blow of the axe, the laughter and whispering from the bedroom grew louder, and the old woman was simply shaking with mirth. He was rushing away, but the passage was full of people. The doors of the flats stood open, and on the landing, on the stairs, and everywhere below, there were people, rows of heads, all looking, but huddled together in silence and expectation. Something gripped his heart. His legs were rooted to the spot. They wouldn't move. He tried to scream and woke up. He drew a deep breath. But his dream seemed strangely to persist. His door was flung open, and a man whom he had never seen stood in the doorway watching him intently. Raskolnikov had hardly opened his eyes, and he instantly closed them again. He lay on his back without stirring. "Is it still a dream?" he wondered, and again raised his eyelids, hardly perceptibly. The stranger was standing in the same place, still watching him. He stepped cautiously into the room, carefully closing the door after him, went up to the table, paused a moment, still keeping his eyes on Raskolnikov, and noiselessly seated himself on the chair by the sofa. He put his hat on the floor beside him, and leaned his hands on his cane and his chin on his hands. It was evident that he was prepared to wait indefinitely. As far as Raskolnikov could make out from his stolen glances, he was a man no longer young, stout, with a full, fair, almost whitish beard. 10 minutes passed. It was still light, but beginning to get dusk. There was complete stillness in the room. Not a sound came from the stairs. Only a big fly buzzed and fluttered against the window pane. It was unbearable at last. Raskolnikov suddenly got up and sat on the sofa. "Come, tell me what you want."
"I knew you were not asleep, but only pretending,"
the stranger answered oddly, laughing calmly.
"Allow me to introduce myself. Arkady Ivanovich Svidrigaylov."
Part 4 Chapter 1 "Can this be still a dream?" Raskolnikov thought once more. He looked carefully and suspiciously at the unexpected visitor.
"Svidrigaylov? What nonsense! It can't be!"
he said at last aloud in bewilderment. His visitor did not seem at all surprised at this exclamation.
"I've come to you for two reasons. In the first place, I wanted to make your personal acquaintance, as I have already heard a great deal about you that is interesting and flattering. Secondly, I cherish the hope that you may not refuse to assist me in a matter directly concerning the welfare of your sister, Avdotya Romanovna. For without your support she might not let me come near her now, for she is prejudiced against me. But with your assistance, I reckon on—"
"You reckon wrongly," interrupted Raskolnikov.
"They only arrived yesterday, may I ask you?"
Raskolnikov made no reply.
"It was yesterday, I know. I only arrived myself the day before. Well, let me tell you this, Rodion Romanovitch. I don't consider it necessary to justify myself. But kindly tell me, what was there particularly criminal on my part in all this business? Speaking without prejudice, with common sense."
Raskolnikov continued to look at him in silence.
"That in my own house I persecuted a defenseless girl and insulted her with my infamous proposals, is that it? I am anticipating you. But you've only to assume that I, too, am a man et nihil humanum. In a word, that I am capable of being attracted and falling in love, which does not depend on our will. Then everything can be explained in the most natural manner. The question is, am I a monster? Or am I myself a victim? And what if I am a victim? In proposing to the object of my passion to elope with me to America or Switzerland, I may have cherished the deepest respect for her, and may have thought that I was promoting our mutual happiness. Reason is the slave of passion, you know. Why, probably, I was doing more harm to myself than anyone."
"But that's not the point," Raskolnikov interrupted with disgust. "It's simply that whether you are right or wrong, we dislike you. We don't want to have anything to do with you. We show you the door. Go out." Svidrigaïlov broke into a sudden laugh.
But there's no getting round you," he said, laughing in the frankest way. "I hoped to get round you, but you took up the right line at once."
"But you are trying to get round me still."
"What of it? What of it?" cried Svidrigaïlov, laughing openly. "But this is what the French call bonne guerre, and the most innocent form of deception. But still you have interrupted me, one way or another. I repeat again, there would never have been any unpleasantness except for what happened in the garden. Marfa Petrovna—"
"You have got rid of Marfa Petrovna too, so they say," Raskolnikov interrupted rudely.
"Oh, you've heard that too, then. You'd be sure to, though. But as for your question, I really don't know what to say, though my own conscience is quite at rest on that score. Don't suppose that I am in any apprehension about it. All was regular and in order. The medical inquiry diagnosed apoplexy due to bathing immediately after a heavy dinner and a bottle of wine. And indeed it could have proved nothing else. But I'll tell you what I have been thinking to myself of late, on my way here in the train especially. Didn't I contribute to all that calamity, morally, in a way, by irritation or something of the sort? But I came to the conclusion that that, too, was quite out of the question." Raskolnikov laughed.
"I wonder you trouble yourself about it.
But what are you laughing at? Only consider, I struck her just twice with a switch. There were no marks, even. Don't regard me as a cynic, please. I am perfectly aware how atrocious it was of me and all that. But I know for certain, too, that Marfa Petrovna was very likely pleased at my, so to say, warmth. The story of your sister had been wrung out to the last drop.
For the last 3 days Marfa Petrovna had been forced to sit at home. She had nothing to show herself with in the town. Besides, she had bored them so with that letter. You heard about her reading the letter. And all of a sudden, those two switches fell from heaven. Her first act was to order the carriage to be got out. Not to speak of the fact that there are cases when women are very, very glad to be insulted in spite of all their show of indignation. There are instances of it with everyone. Human beings in general, indeed, greatly love to be insulted. Have you noticed that? But it's particularly so with women. One might even say it's their only amusement. At one time Raskolnikov thought of getting up and walking out, and so finishing the interview. But some curiosity and even a sort of prudence made him linger for a moment. "You are fond of fighting?" he asked carelessly. "No, not very," Svidrigaïlov answered calmly. "And Marfa Petrovna and I scarcely ever fought. We lived very harmoniously, and she was always pleased with me. I only used the whip twice in all our 7 years, not counting a third occasion of a very ambiguous character. The first time, 2 months after our marriage, immediately after we arrived in the country, and the last time was that of which we are speaking. Did you suppose I was such a monster, such a reactionary, such a slave driver? By the way, do you remember, Rodion Romanovich, how a few years ago, in those days of beneficent publicity, a nobleman, I've forgotten his name, was put to shame everywhere in all the papers for having thrashed a German woman in the railway train. Remember? It was in those days, that very year, I believe, the disgraceful action of the age took place. You know, the Egyptian nights, that public reading, you remember? The dark eyes, you know, the golden days of our youth. Where are they? Well, as for the gentleman who thrashed the German, I feel no sympathy with him, because, after all, what need is there for sympathy? But I must say that there are sometimes such provoking Germans that I don't believe there is a progressive who could quite answer for himself. No one looked at the subject from that point of view then. But that's the truly humane point of view, I assure you. After saying this, Svidrigaïlov broke into a sudden laugh again. Raskolnikov saw clearly that this was a man with a firm purpose in his mind and able to keep it to himself. "I expect you've not talked to anyone for some days," he asked.
"Scarcely anyone. I suppose you are wondering at my being such an adaptable man."
"No, I am only wondering at your being too adaptable a man."
"Because I am not offended at the rudeness of your questions, is that it? But why take offense? As you asked, so I answered," he replied with a surprising expression of simplicity. "You know, there's hardly anything I take interest in," he went on, as it were dreamily. "Especially now I've nothing to do. You are quite at liberty to imagine, though, that I am making up to you with a motive, particularly as I told you I want to see your sister about something. But I'll confess frankly, I am very much bored. The last 3 days especially, so I am delighted to see you. Don't be angry, Rodion Romanovich, but you seem to be somehow awfully strange yourself. Say what you like, there's something wrong with you, and now, too. Not this very minute, I mean, but now, generally. Well, I won't. Don't scowl. I am not such a bear, you know, as you think."
Raskolnikov looked gloomily at him. "You are not a bear, perhaps, at all," he said. "I think, indeed, that you are a man of very good breeding, or at least know how, on occasion, to behave like one.
I am not particularly interested in anyone's opinion,"
Svidrigailov answered, dryly and even with a shade of haughtiness.
"And therefore why not be vulgar at times when vulgarity is such a convenient cloak for our climate? And especially if one has a natural propensity that way," he added, laughing again.
"But I've heard you have many friends here. You are, as they say, not without connections. What can you want with me, then, unless you've some special object?"
"That's true that I have friends here," Svidrigailov admitted, not replying to the chief point. "I've met some already. I've been lounging about for the last 3 days, and I've seen them, or they've seen me. That's a matter of course. I am well dressed, and reckoned not a poor man. The emancipation of the serfs hasn't affected me. My property consists chiefly of forests and water meadows. The revenue has not fallen off, but I am not going to see them. I was sick of them long ago. I've been here 3 days and have called on no one. What a town it is! How has it come into existence among us? Tell me that. A town of officials and students of all sorts. Yes, there's a great deal I didn't notice when I was here 8 years ago, kicking up my heels. My only hope now is in anatomy. By God, it is.
Anatomy?
But as for these clubs, do so, parades, or progress, indeed, maybe, well, all that can go on without me,"
he went on, again without noticing the question.
"Besides, who wants to be a card sharper?"
"Why, have you been a card sharper, then?"
"How could I help being? There was a regular set of us, men of the best society, 8 years ago. We had a fine time. And all men of breeding, you know, poets, men of property. And indeed, as a rule in our Russian society, the best manners are found among those who've been thrashed. Have you noticed that? I've deteriorated in the country. But I did get into prison for debt, through a low Greek who came from Nezhin. Then Marfa Petrovna turned up. She bargained with him, and bought me off for 30,000 silver pieces. I owed 70,000. We were united in lawful wedlock, and she bore me off into the country like a treasure. You know, she was 5 years older than I. She was very fond of me. For 7 years I never left the country, and take note that all my life she held a document over me, the IOU for 30,000 rubles. So if I were to elect to be restive about anything, I should be trapped at once. And she would have done it. Women find nothing incompatible in that."
"If it hadn't been for that, would you have given her the slip?"
"I don't know what to say. It was scarcely the document restrained me. I didn't want to go anywhere else. Marfa Petrovna herself invited me to go abroad, saying I was bored, but I've been abroad before, and always felt sick there. For no reason but the sunrise, the Bay of Naples, the sea. You look at them, and it makes you sad. What's most revolting is that one is really sad. No, it's better at home. Here at least one blames others for everything and excuses oneself. I should have gone, perhaps, on an expedition to the North Pole, because j'ai le vin mauvais, and hate drinking, and there's nothing left but wine. I have tried it. But I've been told Berg is going up in a great balloon next Sunday, from the Yusupov Garden, and will take up passengers at a fee. Is it true?"
"Why, would you go up?"
"I... no. Oh, no,"
muttered Svidrigailov, really seeming to be deep in thought. "What does he mean? Is he in earnest?" Raskolnikov wondered.
"No, the document didn't restrain me," Svidrigailov went on meditatively. "It was my own doing, not leaving the country. And nearly a year ago Marfa Petrovna gave me back the document on my name day, and made me a present of a considerable sum of money, too. She had a fortune, you know. You see how I trust you, Arkady Ivanovich. That was actually her expression. You don't believe she used it? But do you know, I managed the estate quite decently. They know me in the neighborhood. I ordered books, too. Marfa Petrovna at first approved, but afterwards she was afraid of my overstudying.
You seem to be missing Marfa Petrovna very much.
Missing her? Perhaps. Really, perhaps I am. And, by the way, do you believe in ghosts?
What ghosts?
Why, ordinary ghosts.
Do you believe in them?
Perhaps not, pour vous plaire. I wouldn't say no, exactly.
Do you see them, then?
Svidrigailov looked at him rather oddly.
Marfa Petrovna is pleased to visit me,
he said, twisting his mouth into a strange smile. How do you mean she is pleased to visit you?
She has been three times. I saw her first on the very day of the funeral, an hour after she was buried. It was the day before I left to come here. The second time was the day before yesterday at daybreak, on the journey at the station of Malaya Vishera, and the third time was 2 hours ago, in the room where I am staying. I was alone.
Were you awake?
Quite awake. I was wide awake every time. She comes, speaks to me for a minute, and goes out at the door, always at the door. I can almost hear her.
What made me think that something of the sort must be happening to you? Raskolnikov said suddenly. At the same moment he was surprised at having said it. He was much excited.
What? Did you think so?
Svidrigailov asked in astonishment. Did you, really? Didn't I say that there was something in common between us, eh?
You never said so,
Raskolnikov cried sharply and with heat.
Didn't I?
No.
I thought I did. When I came in and saw you lying with your eyes shut, pretending, I said to myself at once, here's the man.
What do you mean by the man? What are you talking about? Cried Raskolnikov.
What do I mean? I really don't know,
Svidrigailov muttered ingenuously, as though he too were puzzled. For a minute they were silent. They stared in each other's faces.
That's all nonsense, Raskolnikov shouted with vexation. What does she say when she comes to you?
She? Would you believe it, she talks of the silliest trifles, and man is a strange creature. It makes me angry. The first time she came in, I was tired, you know, the funeral service, the funeral ceremony, the lunch afterwards. At last I was left alone in my study. I lighted a cigar and began to think. She came in at the door. You've been so busy today, Arkady Ivanovich. You have forgotten to wind the dining-room clock, she said. All those 7 years I've wound that clock every week. And if I forgot it, she would always remind me. The next day I set off on my way here. I got out at the station at daybreak. I'd been asleep, tired out, with my eyes half open. I was drinking some coffee. I looked up, and there was suddenly Marfa Petrovna, sitting beside me with a pack of cards in her hands. Shall I tell you your fortune for the journey, Arkady Ivanovich? She was a great hand at telling fortunes. I shall never forgive myself for not asking her to. I ran away in a fright. And besides, the bell rang. I was sitting today, feeling very heavy after a miserable dinner from a cookshop. I was sitting smoking. All of a sudden, Marfa Petrovna again. She came in very smart in a new green silk dress with a long train. "Good day, Arkady Ivanovich. How do you like my dress? Aniska can't make like this." Aniska was a dressmaker in the country, one of our former serf girls who had been trained in Moscow, a pretty wench. She stood turning round before me. I looked at the dress, and then I looked carefully, very carefully, at her face. "I wonder you trouble to come to me about such trifles, Marfa Petrovna." "Good gracious, you won't let one disturb you about anything." To tease her, I said, "I want to get married, Marfa Petrovna." "That's just like you, Arkady Ivanovich. It does you very little credit to come looking for a bride when you've hardly buried your wife. And if you could make a good choice, at least, but I know it won't be for your happiness or hers, you will only be a laughing stock to all good people." And she went out, and her train seemed to rustle. Isn't it nonsense, huh?
"But perhaps you are telling lies," Raskolnikov put in.
"I rarely lie," answered Svidrigailov thoughtfully, apparently not noticing the rudeness of the question.
"And in the past, have you ever seen ghosts before?"
Yes, I have seen them, but only once in my life, 6 years ago. I had a serf, Filka. Just after his burial, I called out, forgetting, "Filka, my pipe!" He came in and went to the cupboard where my pipes were. I sat still and thought, he's doing it out of revenge, because we had a violent quarrel just before his death. "How dare you come in with a hole in your elbow," I said. "Go away, you scamp." He turned and went out, and never came again. I didn't tell Marfa Petrovna at the time. I wanted to have a service sung for him, but I was ashamed.
"You should go to a doctor."
"I know I am not well, without your telling me, though I don't know what's wrong. I believe I am 5 times as strong as you are. I didn't ask you whether you believe that ghosts are seen, but whether you believe that they exist."
"No, I won't believe it," Raskolnikov cried with positive anger.
"What do people generally say?" muttered Svidrigailov, as though speaking to himself, looking aside and bowing his head. "They say you are ill, so what appears to you is only unreal fantasy. But that's not strictly logical. I agree that ghosts only appear to the sick, but that only proves that they are unable to appear except to the sick, not that they don't exist."
"Nothing of the sort," Raskolnikov insisted irritably.
"No? You don't think so?" Svidrigailov went on, looking at him deliberately. "But what do you say to this argument? Help me with it. Ghosts are, as it were, shreds and fragments of other worlds, the beginning of them. A man in health has, of course, no reason to see them, because he is above all a man of this earth, and is bound, for the sake of completeness and order, to live only in this life. But as soon as one is ill, as soon as the normal, earthly order of the organism is broken, one begins to realize the possibility of another world. And the more seriously ill one is, the closer becomes one's contact with that other world. So that as soon as the man dies,
he steps straight into that world.
I thought of that long ago. If you believe in a future life, you could believe in that too.
I don't believe in a future life.